This past week, Shimon Peres, the Prime Minister of Israel, was visiting in Rome. He went to see Mr. Craxi, the Italian Prime Minister. On their agenda were a number of items. Mr. Craxi is, for this period, half year, the chairman of the Council of the European Community. Israel is obviously very much interested in the role that that community will or will not play in the attempts by the Arab world to get some kind of advantageous for them negotiations going in the Middle East. While he was in Rome, Mr. Peres visited the Pope, John Paul II at the Vatican, and he represented the one community in the world which really by centuries antedates the Vatican as a fixture in Rome. Three centuries before there was a priest in Rome, five centuries before there was a bishop in Rome, eight centuries before the Pope had become the Pope, there was a Jewish community in Rome. And in a way it is paradoxical that these, the oldest settlers in Rome, find it difficult for these newcomers represented by the Pope and the Vatican to recognize not so much the existence of the Jewish community in Rome, but the existence of the Jewish people. The papacy has yet to recognize the Jewish state. The papal newspaper continues largely to describe Israel as the Holy Land. And though there have been a number of contacts between the Vatican and Israel on a number of issues, the papacy, this particular papacy, which concerns itself as trying to project to the world an image of being forthcoming and in the leadership and the van of issues of justice, peace, has been so behind the times, so unwilling to accept reality, and to admit that a scheme they proposed many years ago, which would give them some kind of political political say in the fate of Jerusalem, will not be affected, and that Jerusalem, whatever it means to the other religions of the world, will be the capital of the Jewish state. I found it also rather interesting that at this week, when we were going to talk about the Jewish community in Rome, we would be reminded of the visit by Jewish diplomats and statesmen to Rome. Because the very first historic record of the relationship between Jews and Rome, in this case the Roman Republic, is to be dated from the year 161 before the Common Era. In the year 165, 4 years before, Judah the Maccabee had, with his Hasmonean family and the Judeans, reconquered the Temple Mount from the Syrian Greeks, cleansed it, begun again the appropriate worship of God there, and had given us the holiday of Hanukkah. But once Hanukkah was established, it did not mean that there was peace in the land. The war between the Seleucids, the Syrian Greeks, and the Hasmoneans, the Judeans, went on for nearly another 20 years. And during that period of time, Judah looked around for support, political support, financial support, military support. And he did so at a time when the Roman Republic was beginning to show a great deal of interest in what was happening in the Eastern Mediterranean, when it was part of Roman policy to undermine the strength of the great Hellenistic empires that Alexander had left behind, the Ptolemies in Egypt, the Seleucids in Syria. And they were quite willing to receive ambassadors from those who were rebelling against these various power, imperial powers, to use these states for their own particular purposes. And in the chronicles of the Hasmoneans, that is, of the Judah's descendants who ruled in Palestine for about 80 years after the first Hanukkah, We find in the first book of Maccabees a record of the delegation led by a noble priest and a nobleman sent by Judah to Rome, where they were received with all appropriate pomp and circumstance. And this is the text as we have it. Judah the Maccabee accordingly chose Eupolemus, the son of John, a priest, and Jason, the son of Eleazar, and sent them to Rome to conclude a treaty of friendship and alliance, so that the Romans might rid themselves may rid them of tyranny. For it is clear that the Greek Empire was reducing Israel to slavery. The ambassadors made the long journey to Rome and entered the Senate, where they spoke as follows. Judah, known as the Maccabee, his brothers, and the Judean people, have sent us to you to conclude a treaty of friendly alliance with you, so we may be enrolled as your allies and friends. The Romans found the proposal acceptable, and the following is a copy of the reply which they inscribed upon tablets of bronze and sent to Jerusalem, so that the Jews there might have a record of this treaty of alliance. And this is the text. Success to the Romans and the Jewish nation by sea and land forever. May sword and foe be far from them. But if war breaks out first against Rome or any of her allies throughout her dominion, the Jewish nation shall support them wholeheartedly as occasion may require. The enemies of Rome or of her allies, the Jews shall neither give nor supply provisions, arms, money, or ships. So Rome has decided, and they shall observe their commitments without compensation. Similarly, if war breaks out first among the Jewish nation against the Jewish nation, then the Romans shall give them hearty support as occasion may require. To their enemies there shall be given neither provisions, arms, money, nor ships. So Rome has decided. These commitments shall be kept without breach of faith. These are the terms of agreement which the Romans have made with the Jewish people. But if hereafter both parties shall agree to add or to rescind anything, then they shall do as they decide. Any such additions or rescindment shall be valid. The text of such mutual defense treaties have not changed very much in the last 2,200 or 2,300 years. And this was as true then as is true today, that when nations sign treaties of friendship, each has its own hidden or not so hidden agenda. The Roman agenda, the Judean agenda, was to survive. The Roman agenda was to extend the Imperium of Rome into the East. And not many decades later, in the 70s of the before the Common Era, Rome dispatched two of her ablest generals, Lucullus and Pompey, east, and the legions that they led overran the remnants of the Seleucid Empire, and this was annexed to Rome. And they treated Judea without direct annexation by turning Judea into essentially a puppet state. Pompey found when he went east that the Hasmoneans were fighting among themselves. They were for the moment being ruled by a queen, Salome Alexandra. And Salome had two sons, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. And the two sons had taken armies into the fields and were fighting with each other to see who would have the right of inheritance. And after listening to the arguments of both sides, which was essentially who had the bigger bribe to give, Pompey decided he would support the friends, the allies of Hyrcanus. And the party of Hyrcanus opened the gates of Jerusalem to the Roman legions. And Pompey entered the city and invested it. And then he besieged the remnants of the party of Aristobulus on the Temple Mount. And somewhat to the chagrin of Hyrcanus and his party, who had not anticipated this, he reduced the defenses of the Temple Mount and entered the temple, which was prohibited to those who were pagan. In any case, the might of Rome could not be opposed, and Pompey brought back with him to Rome a large number of Judean war captives who became a large portion of the first Jewish community of Rome. There had been traders and other people who had come to Rome in the previous century or so, but this was the first large body of Jews, of Judeans. They were brought as prisoners of war. There were noblemen among them, and there were peasants among them. And as is the case, some were killed, many were sold into slavery, some ultimately became freedmen. And this community now numbered 5,000, 6,000 souls, and is the beginning of a sizable Jewish presence in Rome. Because Pompey had violated the authority which Hyrcanus had thought he had and desecrated the temple by entering into the Holy of Holies, when war broke out subsequently between Caesar and Pompey, Hyrcanus sided with Caesar, the Jewish community around the Roman world sided with Caesar, and they lent him great support in his then worldwide struggle for ultimate authority in the Roman Republic. And when Caesar won the day, Caesar proclaimed a number of regulations which became the basis of Jewish life in the pagan Roman world for the next three centuries. The Jews were declared a religio licita, that is, a legitimate religion who had the right to publicly carry out their rituals and their services. Jews were given the right to organize as a collegia, that is, a group of people who could meet together publicly for civic purposes. They were allowed the right of collecting in all of their communities what was called the fiscus judaeus, the temple tax, a half shekel, or a dollar or so, collected from every Jew around the world for the upkeep of the temple in Jerusalem. They were allowed to establish their prosuches, which was the Latin term for synagogues, their synagogues in Rome and in the empire. And this kind of rather favorable treatment remained essentially the basis of the Jewish legitimacy in Rome and in the Roman Empire until the age of Constantine in the fourth century. That was not always easy sailing for the Jews of Rome. On the one level, there were the patrician Jews, the nobles, who came as hostages, who came as members of a lofty elite class, and who mingled with the elite of Rome. And we have evidence of Jews being raised as adopted sons by Augustus and by Claudius and by other of the Roman hierarchy. On the other hand, most of the Jews of Rome were impoverished. They were small artisans, small shopkeepers. A number of them were beggars. A number of them were actors, which seems to have been one of the lowest of professions in that time and place. And they were part of the urban proletariat of Rome. The community tended to center on the right bank of the river in Transtevere. And we know that by this first century, they'd established 12 or 13 synagogues. It's estimated that there were between 20 and 40,000 Jews in Rome out of a population of about 1 million. Their lives were not always easy. On the one hand, the patricians were accepted for their class and their wealth. On the other hand, the Judeans, after all, had an oriental religion which the pagans of Rome did not understand. Their mythology was far more austere and their religion far more state-centered. And many were looked upon as sorcerers or magicians and fortune-tellers and people of that kind. And I'm afraid we had our share of Gnothum, not such nice citizens. In the year 19, we have an interesting incident. And it's an incident which is revealing at this one and the same time of the fear of the strange and of the attraction of the strange to Rome. It's very clear from historical evidence that a number of the patrician class particularly were attracted to Judaism and became at the very least Sabbath observers. There was no such thing as a rest day in Rome, a Sunday or a Sabbath day. And those who became Jewish converts were known largely by the fact that they were Sabbath observers. One day of the week was a rest day to them. As a matter of fact, one of the satires which Juvenal and others who wrote these kinds of plays raise against the Jews is that they're lazy. Proof, one day a week they won't work. In any case, there was a woman named Fulvia, a noble woman. Her husband, a man named Saturninus, was a rich senator in Rome. And Fulvia was attracted to Judaism. She was a Sabbath observer. And as today the organizations in Israel send out shlichim, schnorrers, people to raise money for one cause or another, and a group of shlichim came from the temple, or presumably came from the temple in Jerusalem, And they raised from Fulvia a great deal of money to guarantee that a plaque would be put up to her on the wall of the temple in Jerusalem. The problem was they were thieves, con men. And they simply pocketed this gold and this silver and went their way. And Saturninus, who had good contacts in Rome, complained to the council of the year, a man named Sejanus. And Sejanus, who was interested anyway in eradicating the Orientalization of many of the people of Rome, apparently ordered the expulsion of the Jews, which was incidentally not carried out. But he did, in fact, round up several hundred Jewish young men whom he conscripted into the army and sent off to Sardinia, where these Jews were put to the work of trying to go into the mountains to root out the robbers who lived off of the tariffs by preying on the traders who moved from city to city. One of the interesting things about Rome is that a great deal of Roman energy in the first and second century was spent in fighting Jews. The Jews, after all, rose in revolt against Rome in the year 66. They remained in revolt for 6 years until their revolt was finally crushed in 72. The temple, as you remember, was destroyed. It's a very costly rebellion for the Romans as well as for the Jews. The Jews of Tripoli, of Libya, of Cyprus, and of parts of North Africa rose in rebellion in the year 112, 115. The issue was almost always taxation. Rome ruled with an iron fist. And then again in 132, under Bar Kokhba, you'll recall there was a second great revolt in Judea. For a time, Bar Kokhba was able to recapture Jerusalem until in 135, the Roman legions again overwhelmed the Judean resistance. Now, despite these constant battles with Jews, with the Judeans, or with Jews of the diaspora, the Jews in Rome seem not to have suffered because of the actions of their co-religionists. Nor, incidentally, do they seem to have very much gone to the defense of their co-religionists. "We are one" is one of those slogans which is often proven by the exception rather than by the rule. One is not sure what the Jewish community of Rome could have done on behalf of the Jews rebelling in the Middle East. But we do know that when John of Giscala and Simon Bar Giora and the other leaders of the revolt and thousands of those of the soldiers who had fought in the revolt were marched in Titus's triumphal procession in Rome, back to Rome, and many were sacrificed to the animals or to the gladiators in the arena, which incidentally the Colosseum had been built largely with Jewish war captives brought back by Pompey, that the Jews of Rome were there. Must have watched these Judeans being brought in chains into the capital. The same thing occurred again after the defeat of 135. And it's interesting to note that there was in Jerusalem at the time a group of people who seemed to have been relatively indifferent of Jews to the fate of their fellow Jews. Titus, he who destroyed the temple, had a mistress by the name of Berenice, a Jewess, who was a princess of the Hasmonean house. And one of the great captives brought back from Judea, former general of the Judean army, Josephus, was brought back because he had prophesied to Vespasian that he would become emperor. And he became emperor and remembered this Oriental who had prophesied so well for him. And he wrote the famous histories of the Jews in order to justify being a Benedict Arnold, but at the same time to reveal to the Romans the glories of the glorious history of the Jewish community. And somehow these two worlds coexisted, the world in which Jews were revolting and were being defeated in their homeland, the role of the capital of the diaspora in which a community was struggling to survive, and accepted for an occasional act of anger which was vented against them, managed to survive with a good deal of ease given the situation for the next several centuries. The great change which overcame the Jewish community of Rome would not come to the age of Constantine. And what we know of the earlier history, we know not only from a few texts, but we know also from the catacombs, the evidence of the mausoleums of this Jewish community. The Romans cremated their dead. Judeans were in the habit of burying their dead. The dead would be buried in the ground. The bones would then be collected, and they would be put in Judea in caves. In Rome, the practice seems to have been to put the body directly into an underground burial place, an underground mausoleum. And these mausoleums were extensive. Their Mayfield cemeteries were of the size of ours, except they were all underground. And we believe that between the 2nd century before the Common Era and the 3rd century of the Common Era, there must have been upwards of 100,000 such burials of Jews in Rome. When you go to Rome, and you're taken to see the catacombs, all the catacombs that you visit are Christian catacombs. The Christians of Rome got the custom of burying their dead in this way from the Jews, who had already been doing it for several centuries before Christians ever came to Rome. And, of course, the religious communities buried their own in their own caves. We don't know how many of these catacombs. The name seems to come from a particular district in Rome where a number of these underground caverns were cut out. We don't know how many existed at one time. 6 have been visited and located in the last century or so. 3 of these have not yet been lost to urban expansion, lost to the great shovels of the contractors as they build foundations for apartments and whatnot. And these catacombs have yielded any number of inscriptions, some 600 of them, which tell us a good bit about the inner history of this community. We know, for instance, that almost all of the inscriptions are in Greek, not in Latin. Few are in Hebrew. Hebrew is limited to an occasional shalom, shalom al Yisrael, peace to Israel. Clearly, it was a Hebraically illiterate community. It was a community that's like most of the Jews, Eastern Mediterranean, spoke Greek and continued to speak Greek long after Roman domination. Although in the 2nd and 3rd century graves, Latin becomes more pronounced. By and large, as in America today, the Jews named their children and grandchildren with the conventional names of the community rather than with biblical names. You find Procopius and Nicanor and Julia rather than Ruth or Jonathan. Or you never find Abraham. There's no Joseph. There's no Moses. There's no Isaiah. They're simply the names that are familiar names to the Roman world, including, interestingly, the names of gods of the Roman and Greek worlds. On the other hand, we find evidence of great interest in synagogues. 13 synagogues are named. A number of men are identified as archisynagogos, which would be the equivalent of president of the synagogue, or gerousiarchs, members of the synagogue board. The board was called the gerousia. A number of these people had indications that they had converted to Judaism. There's one inscription which tells us a certain Baturia, a Roman matron, converted at the age of 70, took the name Sarah, and then for the last 16 years of her life was declared mother of a particular synagogue. She must have been a fairly wealthy woman who gave a good bit of money to that particular synagogue. If you want a title as mother, I'll give it to you. For a price. It was not an educated community. We know of no scholars who were native-born. We hear in the Talmud of a certain Thutis, a very well-intentioned Jew of Rome, who tried to organize the community and who wanted to remind them that they ought to be pious. And so he decided that the Jewish community ought to do what the Bible says Jews do, and that is to sacrifice the Paschal sacrifice on the Passover. And a delegation happened at that time to be coming from Palestine, and they were aghast at this idea that outside of Jerusalem you would actually sacrifice the lamb for the Passover, and they gently reminded Thutis that this was no longer the way, even though the Bible suggests that it is the way. And they decided when they got back to Jerusalem that they better send one of their own, a scholar, to Rome to put things right. And so they sent a man named Matityahu ben Cheresh, a scholar, to Rome. And he established a school, and he put things right, and when he died, things went right back to being as they had always been. In the 4th century, fate turned against the Jewish community of Rome. Constantine proclaimed what's called the Edict of Toleration, which was the acceptance of Christianity as a religion which could be practiced openly. And then he did two things which were forever after to affect Jewish life in the Mediterranean area, and particularly in Italy and in Rome. The first is that he moved the capital from Rome to Byzantium. He moved the central administrative authority eastward. Rome became essentially a provincial center. It was no longer the capital of a great empire. And secondly, through his conversion, Christianity ultimately becomes the church state of the empire. And those who had been for some time persecuted became the persecutors quickly. And a whole series of laws were passed which undid all the edicts which Caesar had promulgated so many centuries before. Now Jews were prohibited from sending money to Jerusalem for any purpose. The fiscus Judaeus was still collected, but went for particular purposes of the state. They were prohibited from owning slaves, which meant that they couldn't engage in any kind of medium or large-scale farming or manufacturing. They could not intermarry with non-Jews under pain of death. They could not convert a non-Jew under pain of death. Increasingly, they were to wear certain kinds of distinctive garments. They were not to be allowed the permission to build any new synagogues or to repair existing synagogues. And that whole unfortunate medieval coterie of laws, which are the origin of the rules of apartheid, religious apartheid, began to become the law of the Roman Empire. And of course, many of the churchmen in their fanaticism encouraged from time to time the mobs to attack the synagogues, to attack Jews. So Rome goes through a long period of decline. By the 5th or 6th century, the city of 1 million had become a city of less than 50,000. And by the Jewish community goes into a similar kind of decline. Interestingly, in the year 453, when the Vandals attacked this once great capital and captured it, they found in the Temple of Peace the vessels which Titus had brought from the Temple of Jerusalem 5 centuries before. The great golden menorah, table of the showbread, all of the great vessels of the temple had been kept on the forum in the Temple of Peace for all those centuries on public exhibit. And the Vandals sweeping through, looking only for booty, simply took all of these vessels and took them with them to North Africa, where they disappear entirely from view. They're apparently melted down and used for coin or for some other purpose. Rome goes into a period where it's a pale shadow of his former self. The Dark Ages come. The papacy establishes itself as a dominant authority in Rome, 8th, 9th centuries. The papacy is a small island of literate people in a larger pond of largely illiterate peoples. And it's precisely at this time that the Jewish community of Rome emerges as a learned community. We don't know quite how it all happened, but we do know that by the 9th century, and particularly in the 10th century, Rome becomes a center of rabbinic scholarship. There's a family known as Colonimus, which is, many of whom composed religious poetry for the synagogue, others of whom are known for having written books dealing with various aspects of Jewish law. There was another group of families known as Yechiel, and a man named Nathan ben Yechiel of Rome wrote what was essentially the Encyclopedia Britannica of Jewish life in the Middle Ages. It was called the Aruch, that which is complete. It was a complete drawing together of all the historic, legal information about Jewish life as it was developed in the Talmud, in the Midrashim, in the codes, and along with Rashi's commentary on the Talmud and Maimonides' great code of law. The Aruch was the third of the great texts which gave to medieval Jewry the basic knowledge of rabbinism on which they developed their learning. And so in the 9th and 10th century, Rome has a smallish Jewish community of maybe 2,000 or 3,000 souls, But it is now a rabbinic community. It is now a community which has its own schools. It has its own rabbis. It develops a literary tradition of some quality. And it is, by and large, saved by the fact that the papacy requires the literacy of members of this community for a number of its important functions. And so one of the paradoxes of the Middle Ages is that though it was in Rome that most of the harshest apartheid legislation imposed by the church on Jewish communities in Christendom was promulgated, it was in Rome that until the 16th century, the Jewish community suffered the least from this apartheid legislation. There were Jews who were physicians to various popes. There were Jews who served in the bureaucracy of various posts, being administrators of one thing or another. There are Jews who provided various kinds of goods and services to those who worked in the papacy. And all during the Middle Ages, there was a kind of a symbiotic relationship between Jews and the papacy, where the papacy would hurl anathemas against Judaism, call Judaism a nefarious faith, the Jews a deicidical people, published what we call the teachings of contempt, but at the same time insists that the person of the Jew must not be attacked and put the Jews of Rome under their personal protection. They were useful to the papacy. And it was during these centuries that the great myth developed of a Jewish pope. It was a very popular myth among the Jewish communities in the Middle Ages. It's told this way, that there was a Jew, an Ashkenazic Jew in Germany, scholar, who had a young son named Elchanan. And Elchanan was kidnapped by priests when he was an infant, a not unusual event in those days, and baptized and brought up in a monastery. And having a Yiddish kopf, being bright, he developed very well in the hierarchy of the lower hierarchies of the church and quickly went up the ladder of the priesthood, the deaconate, became a bishop, and ultimately he became the pope. And once he became the pope, according to the folk legend, he sought to find, the way Joseph did, the truth about his ancestry. And he hauled in, using his authority as pope, the priests who had raised him, the monks who had raised him, and he forced them to tell him about his parentage. He found out who his father was. He brought his father to Rome. They had a reunion. The father convinced the son of the truth of Judaism and therefore of the falsity of Christianity. And the pope, according to this Jewish folk legend, then goes up to the roof of the Vatican Church, delivers a great impassioned message about Judaism to all those who are assembled below, and throws himself down onto the street, committing suicide. Now, the truth of this story is far different. Around the year 1100, a Jew in Rome, who we would call overly ambitious and upwardly mobile, by the name of Baruch, changed his name to Benedictus. He had made a little money, he wanted to protect his money, and it was to his advantage to be baptized. And it wasn't enough to be baptized, he found his way to marry the impoverished daughter of a great Roman noble family, and he continued to amass a fortune as a Catholic. He had a son, he named his son Peter. Peter was as shrewd a banker and as grasping a man as his father had been. And Peter had a son named Leo. And Leo was as good a banker and as greedy a man as his father and his grandfather had been. And by the time that Leo had established this house of Rothschild, they had bought the land on an island in the Tiber River, which sits just opposite Castel San Angelo. And they had built a medieval fortress, which was their turf on this island. And they had become the great banking house of Peter Leon, Pierre Leone. And to establish their authority even further, Leo induced one of his sons to go into the church. And he, through his various donations, ensured the prosperity of his son in church activity and ultimately bought for him the papacy. The papacy was bought for for most of the Middle Ages. The Sforzas or the Pierre Leones or the other one or another of the great houses would simply buy the votes, which would ensure that one of them would rule the lands, because it was a great, it was an empire, and would have the income and the political power which went with the papacy. In this case, it was a Pierre Leones who bought the papacy, and the great-grandson of Baruch became a pope under the name of Anacletus II. Now, no one would have thought much about the fact that a fourth-generation Roman Catholic had become pope if it were not for the myths and the prejudices of the time and the energies of a certain Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard of Clairvaux was one of the great monastic reformers of the time, a Cistercian monk, one of the great preachers of the Crusades. And Bernard of Clairvaux was the school that once a Jew, always a Jew. And he led a great campaign against Anacletus on the grounds that he was of that nefarious tribe, that he was a Jew pope, and no Jew ought to sit on the throne of Christ. And it was because of the fulminations of Bernard of Clairvaux that the myth developed of the Jewish pope. For better or for worse, all popes have been good Catholics. Now, through the Renaissance, the Jewish community in Rome remained under all these rules of apartheid, but protected largely by their contacts with whoever was the pope. But with the Counter-Reformation, in the middle of the 16th century, the situation of the Jewish community of Rome deteriorated rapidly and swiftly and remained the most ghettoized, the most persecuted community in Europe, in Western and Central Europe, until the late 19th century. When Luther preached the Reformation in Europe, he based his complaints against the church on the text of Scripture. And the threatened church began to blame the Jews for having taught Christians to read the Bible. There was some evidence for this. Jews had taught Erasmus and Reuchlin and a number of the other humanists of the Renaissance to read Hebrew, to read Greek, and to read the text themselves and to make up their own minds as to what the text meant. At least they had convinced them that there were other interpretations of the text than the ones that the church always had given them. And because the church blamed the Jews for the struggle for the breakup of the Imperium Christianum, the breakup of the unity of Christendom, Paul IV, the great Counter-Reformation Pope, turned bitterly against the Jews, particularly the Jews of Rome, announced a number of papal bulls in which he enforced the rules of apartheid. The Jews of Rome were now placed into a ghetto. The ghetto was down near the Tiber River in one of the unhealthiest and most pestilential areas of the city. It had one gate. The gate was locked at 8 o'clock every night and not unlocked till 8 o'clock the next morning. The Jews were not allowed to engage in any business except beggary or selling of most ordinary kinds of simple utensils. The Jews were forced to wear a Jew badge of one kind or another. Attacks on Jews were encouraged. It was an ugly and vicious period. And this persecution, which extended to the fact that Jews were forced Sabbath after Sabbath to go into their synagogues to hear conversionist sermons preached by Jesuit priests or representatives of the Vatican. But they were forced to raise money for a house which was called the House of Catechumen, where young Jews who had been kidnapped from their families were being raised by priests to be Christians. And Jews had to pay the costs of this public school, if you will. The Jews had their books had to be censored by church censors, and nothing could be published within this community unless the church permitted it to be published. And I have in my library any number of volumes of the Talmud or other texts, which were printed in Italy or in Rome during this period, in which the censor has gone through and inked out large sections of the text because they were seen to be anti-Catholic or anti-Christian in one way or another. And since we know what the texts really are, most of these texts were, believe me, quite harmless. In any case, it wasn't until Napoleon that Jews were able for a very brief period of time to leave the ghetto. And once Napoleon was defeated, The church quickly put the Jews back into the ghetto, and it was only with the arrival of the armies of Victor Emmanuel in 1870 into Rome that the ghetto walls were broken down and Jews in Rome were allowed to enter the modern world. Roman Jewry had a much shorter experience with modernity than, let's say, the Jews of Paris or the Jews of London or the Jews of Amsterdam. It begins in 1870 and it ends in the middle of the 1930s. But in that short period of time, in those 60, 65 years, the natural processes with which we're familiar of assimilation and acculturation took place. Those who were abler, quickly earned a living, moved out of the ghetto. The ghetto became largely the place where the poor remained. By 1900, there was enough money in Rome and the Jewish community to establish a very magnificent temple. The Jewish community was, however, without real scholarly leadership. Modern Judaism, as we know it, never made inroads in that community. Those who were cultured largely left the community and found their new ideology, their new faith in one or another of the great reform movements of the late 19th and early 20th century. Jews felt so much a part of the Italian world and did so so quickly that any number of the Jews of Italy joined the fascists in the late 20s and early 30s during the early ages of Mussolini. It was their way of proving that they were 101% Italian. And as a matter of fact, in Mussolini's fascism, there was not, in its original promulgation, any real anti-Semitism. Mussolini did not begin to move against Jewish interests until his fateful attack on Ethiopia, which was part of a concerted campaign on his part to push the British out of the Middle East and to replace them with Italians who would dominate as a colonial power the Middle East. And he saw Zionism as an attempt by the British to secure their footholds and their interests in another part of the Middle East. And so he turned violently anti-Zionist. There was a good deal of Zionism, of Zionist interest and activity in the Jewish communities of Italy and the Jewish community of Rome. And he began to turn the screws to prevent the publication of Zionist periodicals, speeches by Zionist leaders and the like. But then with the arrival of Hitler and the arrangements which were developed in the mid-1930s between German fascism and Italian fascism, obviously the anti-Semitism, which was part and parcel of the very purpose of German fascism, began to infect the Italian scene. And the Jews of Italy began to suffer and to be sequestered. But it's interesting to note that as long as Italy remained a partner within the Axis, the Jews of Italy were not deported to the concentration camps and to the death camps. It was not until Italy, in a sense, resigned from the war. Mussolini was, as you remember, killed, and the Italians declared themselves an independent state in 1943. It was not until then that the Jewish community of Rome and of Venice and Milan was directly threatened. By 1943, the Allied armies had occupied the boot of Italy up to somewhat beyond Naples. And so those Jews who lived in the south were now protected by the Allied armies. But Rome was quickly invested by the Germans. And the Germans brought with them Herr Himmler. And Himmler organized a great search of Rome and of the other Italian cities under German control for Jews. And it is in late 1943 that the roundup of the Jews of Italy begins and the deportations and the killings begin. And it is at this point in time that the charges begin to be leveled against the Pope and the Vatican, that they refused to either protest the hunt for Jews. Many Jews were in fact protected by Italian families, and that they refused to defend, do anything in order to defend the rights and the lives of these Italian citizens. In any case, the small Jewish community of Rome, which may have numbered perhaps 15,000-16,000 at the beginning of the war, lost about 3,000 to 4,000 of its citizens due to the war, due to these roundups. But the bulk of the Italian community, which was never that large in recent years, somehow survived. And after the war was over, it began to reassert that process of acculturation, assimilation, which had been going on before the war. There was no great influx of Jews to Italy. Italy has not been a center of economic thrust, of economic prosperity. Many of the young Jews have turned away from their Jewishness and find their salvation in one or another reformist ideology. The Jewish communities, the smaller Jewish communities, have emptied out, and the Jews have come to Milan, to Rome, to the larger centers. Rome today may have 15,000-18,000 Jews. There is a consistory, a Jewish organization, and they are attempting to regain control over their past, over the institutions and the archives, and to get a sense of their history and to create a structure which will be adequate to the new world. It's not been an easy road for them to hoe. The Islamic presence is very powerful in Italy in financial circles. Italy has not been able to impose security on its cities, and Arab and other terrorists have operated with a good deal of freedom, both from the old extreme right of the high church and the new extreme left of the Red Terror and some of the communist groups. There has been a dissemination of anti-Semitic caricatures and attempts to limit the ability of Jews to move into the larger society. But these have, for the most part, not been that successful. And today you'll find the Jewish community of Rome largely a middle-class community, a community of professionals, a community of merchants, a community of doctors and lawyers and architects, a community not unlike almost any community in the free world. It's an interesting history, a history which now goes back 2,200 years. And what's most interesting about the Jews who live in Rome today is that they are trying for the first time to get a handle on and their hands on their own history, which is to say that according to the Concordat of 1870, which was signed between the Republic of Italy and the Vatican, the control of holy places, including the catacombs, was given to the Vatican. And the Vatican has had control of these catacombs, including the Jewish catacombs, ever since. A new concordat, a new set of arrangements has been negotiated in very recent years. And the Jewish community has encouraged the state to get back from the Vatican the rights to the Jewish catacombs, to make them possessions of the state, in the hope that the Jewish community would be able to raise the money to research these catacombs completely, that they'd be able to establish a museum which would tell the history, visually the history of this long-lived community, and would give them a sense of rootage, a sense of possibility, and a sense of the future. And apparently, as these negotiations are moved towards completion, there is good reason to believe that the Jewish community in Rome will gain, through the state, control of the three remaining catacombs which are known, and that this process can, in fact, move ahead. One of the paradoxes of history is that it is a communist minister in the Italian government who has been negotiating on behalf of the Jews to regain this control. It's also hoped that in time, whatever the archaeologists of the Vatican found in the catacombs which have been studied so far will be returned to the Jewish community so they in fact can display. Move towards completion. There's good reason to believe that the Jewish community in Rome will gain, through the state, control of the three remaining catacombs which are known, and that this process can, in fact, move ahead. One of the paradoxes of history is that it is a communist minister in the Italian government who has been negotiating on behalf of the Jews to regain this control. It's also hoped that in time, whatever the archaeologists of the Vatican found in the catacombs which have been studied so far will be returned to the Jewish community so they in fact can display, study their own history. What's the future of the Jewish community of Rome? It's hard to say. Unfortunately, modern Judaism in our sense has had no history, no rootage in this place. What religious teachings there are highly traditional. There is no such thing as a Jewish community center as we know it, or a modern synagogue as we know it, or a modern rabbinate as we know it. And yet there are youth groups, there are Zionist groups, and one suspects that one way or another, whatever adaptation is possible will be attempted, provided there is the critical mass required for the continuation of this eternal Jewish community in the eternal city. That question of critical mass is the same question that faces the Jews of Cleveland, Jews anywhere. Will we have children? Will we have grandchildren? The best educational system, the most highly developed communal structure is useless unless they're human beings to be part of that structure. And as the Jewish community in Cleveland, this Jewish community in Rome becomes a more prosperous community, there seems to be a direct relationship between prosperity and the number of children in the family. The birth rate drops, and inevitably in an open society, there are some who move out and some who move in. But as the birth rate drops, the next generation becomes smaller than the generation it was before. And even if you have the institutions and the will, there may be no community to survive. And in Italy, that sense is palpable. There were something like 28 or 29 Jewish communities in operation in the 1930s throughout Italy. There are only five still in operation today. It's very much as the state of Ohio. Almost every small town in the state of Ohio had a synagogue in the 1920s, in the 1910s and 20s. And then there was the movement to the larger towns. Now the small city towns have largely been denuded of their Jewish communities. They came to the Columbuses, the Cincinnatis, and the Clevelands. And then in the Cleveland, we no longer maintain ourselves. It will be the same thing as in Rome. Ultimately, it will not survive. Rome and Jerusalem represent two of the great religious teachings of the world, eternal communities, interacted on each other over time. We have never been the majority, but we've certainly played a significant role in the history of Christianity, history of the eternal city, and that Jewish community has played a significant role